Rethinking a Lockdown to Stop the Spread, a plan for affordable housing in Miami, and a film festival in the era of a pandemic. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Florida registered another 132 deaths from COVID-19 today, but our leaders are not on the same page when it comes to the best solution. We're joined by Congresswoman Donna Shalala to ask her why she believes another shutdown is necessary. Also, there's a new plan to create more affordable housing opportunities in Miami-Dade. We're going to meet the people behind that plan and learn about a project that could help reshape Little Havana, a community facing gentrification. Finally, we'll tell you about a film festival this week that you could watch from the comfort of your own home. The filmmakers used the pandemic to tell their stories. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Florida is one of the epicenters for the coronavirus nationwide, and the numbers show no signs of improvement. Governor Ron DeSantis is in Miami for a panel conversation with Miami-Dade County Mayor Carlos Jimenez, where he continues to emphasize the importance of social distancing and wearing of masks. To note, the governor wasn't wearing a mask at a news conference in Miami yesterday. Democratic Congresswoman Donna Shalala argues the current restrictions are not enough. In order to reduce the spread of the virus, she believes the state should reinstitute a stay-at-home order for 2 weeks. Do you think a shutdown is necessary? If not, what can we do to slow the growth of the virus? Call in 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-9576. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, WLRN Sundial, and post your question there. Congresswoman Shalala, always a pleasure. Thank you for the time.
You're welcome. Happy to be here.
Why do you believe that we need to have a stay-at-home order now?
Well, we didn't do it the right way in the first time we did it. We allowed too many exceptions, and the virus spun out of control. We opened too soon. It's very clear we didn't follow the White House's own guidelines. It said 14 days of a downward numbers in the COVID-19 infections before you should open up. And we just jumped the gun. And as a result, and we didn't mandate masks. The state has still not mandated masks. The county has, but the state has not. And COVID is now out of control. And there is no substitute. There are no little nuances that you can do. There's no substitute for closing down. I said 4 months ago, the worst thing that could happen to my community is if we have to close down again. So we have to do it right in the first place. We didn't do it right. And now we're in big trouble, serious trouble. Is it worth one life? I don't think so. And I care a lot about the economy in my community.
Do we have to do a full statewide shutdown, or are we just looking at those areas like South Florida, like Miami-Dade, where it's really bad?
Look, the governor is not going to do a statewide shutdown. He doesn't have the guts. He's following the president's lead. He doesn't have the guts to do it. He's totally politicized this. Miami-Dade can do it on its own, and it would help dramatically. Our hospitals are almost full. We've got a very tiny window to get our arms around this and to starve it. And if we don't take advantage of this, we're talking about months of very big numbers.
We talked with Dr. Eileen Marty, infectious disease expert at FIU, earlier today about this idea of a two-week shutdown. This is what she said.
Yes, absolutely. If we instill a lockdown right now, it would tame this outbreak. It would bring this fire under control. However, we must not make the same mistake we did with the last lockdown, which is during the lockdown, you do not belittle the virus. You do not give false information as to the risk. You do let people know that when we open up under the new normal guidelines, we have to actually follow them. And in the meantime, you also build up contact tracing, you increase the staff of contact tracers, you change the interview questionnaire so that it captures the data that decision makers need. Right now, our questionnaires do not do that, and they're still geared towards people who are symptomatic and virtually no not the kind of capture information that you need for the asymptomatic spreading and to contain it.
All right. So Congresswoman, she hits on a lot of things, but she agrees. We have to do it again because we didn't do it right the first time. But really, let me just start with this. What confidence do you have if we did that we would get it right?
Well, we shouldn't do it unless we're prepared to do it right. We shouldn't do a half-baked lockdown. The people in our community are very smart. We have to give them very clear information based on science, on what the public health experts like Dr. Marty, and I talked to her a few minutes ago, like Dr. Marty, really believe will help us to starve this virus. If we do it half-baked, we'll lose confidence again, and we need to build up confidence. So it has to be very strict, very clear, and every part of our community has to agree.
And
every mayor, every commissioner.
And you said it before, that if we don't do it right, we might have to come back to this question of closing down. So now here we are again. But now you got to tell businesses, okay, we're going to have to do this again, and this time it's going to be even tighter. What do you say to them?
Well, for one thing, I'm going back to Washington on Monday, and we need to extend the help to our local businesses. And all I can say to local businesses, and I care deeply about the businesses in my community, I represent a lot of restaurants, hotels, a lot of small businesses in my district, and I'm trying to save them as well. We're first trying to save people's lives, but we're also trying to save our economy. We cannot save our economy unless we starve this virus and get control of it. And as Dr. Marty says, have a strategy when we come out of the lockdown to trace every last case.
And we will be playing more of that conversation, by the way, later this week. Again, talking with Congresswoman Donna Shalala. Again, what are your thoughts? Do we have to shut down again? Is that what it is? And a tighter shutdown, what do you think about that? 800-743-9576. Let me go to the phones. I want to go to John in Miami. John, thanks for waiting.
Good day. How are you doing? We definitely need to lock down for at least 2 weeks. And another thing that amazes me, I mean, you watch the movies, Hollywood, you watch everything. Every president, every Hollywood president listens to scientific advisors. What's going on? Why is it that we're all over the place as a country? We had zero plan. Nothing could prepare us for what we're going through right now. Not one thing. We have the data. We have a prototype in which we opened up early. It didn't work. Why can we not just close it down for 2 weeks? And I understand the economy. I support my small business. I am a small business. I am a handyman. I am getting murdered. That I prefer to stay home for 2 solid weeks without going out, and to make sure that we have a grasp on this thing, we have become from the least amount of cases to the epicenter. How did that happen?
Yeah,
I'm going to tell you how it happened.
Well, John,
go ahead.
It's okay, John. I mean, an interesting point, and you're a business. What I found interesting, you said you're a business owner, so you're in support of this. Considering what that could mean for you. John, thank you for the call. Also, interesting, he brings up presidents and movies. Listen to scientists. Before I go back to the phones, I mean, Congresswoman, you know, how much of this is about local leadership? How much of it is about expecting what is going to happen in Tallahassee or in the White House?
You know, it's too bad we don't have either national leadership or state leadership. Our local governments have been struggling with this, and this is a national disease. This is an international disease, and we haven't had that leadership. You know, Lewis, I don't know why people run for office if they're not willing to make tough decisions. And the idea of not following the science is just, it's dangerous. It's dangerous, as we have seen. And this is about life and death. We're not talking about some political ideology. We're talking about life and death. And that's why I believe strongly that people in our community understand this, and they will understand it if we're very clear, very honest with them about the science and about what we need to do as a community.
I want to go back to the phones, and I want to hear about someone who it may not like the idea of a shutdown. I want to go to Mike in Aventura. Mike, thanks for waiting.
Hi. Okay, I'm kind of against it because, number one, it hurts a lot of people out there. In fact, you know, you talk about the social distancing. I'm totally blind and hard of hearing. How do you deal with 5 to 8 feet social distancing? People have not really told me that much on the subject.
All right. So the issue with people who are dealing with disabilities and how they social distance. But again, as you said, you don't like this idea of a shutdown because it could impact you. Congresswoman, I mean, look, you've got people on different sides of the spectrum here who will tell you one way. They like it. They don't like it. They don't like it for many reasons. As Mike is saying, for him, it's a personal issue, maybe not a business issue. It's a personal issue. He's struggling with this. How do we work with him? How do we help him?
Well, we absolutely need to help him. We need to help every small business in our community. We need to help the medium-sized businesses as well. Every worker in our community needs to be helped, and people with disabilities in particular. We need to reach out to make sure they're not isolated, to make sure they get the food that they need, and to make sure that they understand this is about protecting them. Because in many cases, we're talking about a high-risk population. That's who I'm worried about. And we need to make sure that economically, the Congress has done everything it possibly can do to shore up our economy while we're shutting down, while we're trying to beat this virus.
You know, again, coming back to Dr. Marty, one of the other things that she mentioned in our conversation was about this backlog of testing kits here in Miami-Dade County, and this is what she said about that.
We actually have a whole bunch of different things going on at the same time. There's several commercial labs that are running tests. There are state labs running tests. Some of the individual hospital systems are running their own PCR. Jackson has a huge cadre of different kinds of PCR machines. You never know which one your sample is going to end up with. And they base it on exactly what kit availabilities they have and which machine is freed up.
If we have such a variety of systems, why is there a backlog of tests?
It's a volume number. It's supply and demand. There's way too many people exposed, way too many people actually infected.
So, Congresswoman, I mean, is this something that should be fixed on a federal level? Or
absolutely.
Okay.
And they should have fixed it 5 months ago. Look, we made VCRs uniform. There's no reason why we couldn't make the testing kits uniform. And why we couldn't make, we've just invested billions and billions in the search for a vaccine. What we should have been doing at the same time is investing serious money in testing, in fast testing. We need to be able to tell people right away. That's when we can say to them, yes, you should social isolate. You should isolate yourself for 14 days. Those investments were possible if the federal government invoked the Defense Production Act and took hold. It's one of the few federal functions. Obviously, the federal function in searching for a vaccine and for treatment, but a federal function in being responsible for testing, for PPE. Right now, we have everybody scrambling. And not only does Jackson have a variety of machines, Baptist has a variety of machines. And getting the reagents is difficult. Their turnaround time on the commercial labs is 5 to 7 days. It makes no sense when the federal government could have taken hold here. It's like the Articles of Confederation, where states are competing against each other. Hospitals are competing for supplies against each other. Remember the story about Miami-Dade making a big purchase and the feds came in and swooped it up?
Yeah.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. But we can do it. And we can do it here in our community, and we can be a model for the world.
Again, talking with Democratic Congresswoman Donna Shalala, and as mentioned earlier, you heard in the news, Florida setting a record again, this time in the number of COVID deaths. This week, we've seen record numbers of COVID cases, and again, now record number of COVID deaths in a day. And again, we're talking about what has to happen next. Should there be a lockdown, a full shutdown of the economy here in Florida for the next 2 weeks to try to curb the numbers? I want to go back to the phones. I want to start with John in Fort Lauderdale. John, thanks for waiting.
Hi, thank you both so much for having this conversation today. Congressman Shalala, thank you so much for your hard work. I just wanted to share my opinion here. I'm a trauma sales rep, you know, so I support a lot of our surgeons in some pretty critical functions throughout the majority of hospitals in South Florida. And I don't think a lot of people realize throughout the county and the Tri-County area really just how bad it's getting in some of these facilities. You know, the majority, a large portion of the patients coming in for surgery, even testing positive, converting a lot of the OR space and stuff into areas that are made for COVID patients. So I just, you know, we're seeing so much of the testing lag behind. I mean, I myself, I don't qualify as a first responder, but I had my last test on the 2nd of July, and I still don't have a response today. So, you know, I hate to hear it, but, you know, testing is so critical, and it's really the only thing, I think, at this point that could help us. And I just hope you guys are able to do something about it. So thank you.
John, thank you so much for sharing that with us. Congresswoman, it just comes back. I mean, you said if it's done on a federal level, but, you know, again, you know, waiting for that to happen, if that's not the case, then we have to depend on, you know, the systems that we have in place. This is something interesting he mentioned. He's still waiting for results. I'd mentioned before myself, it took a while for me to get my results.
It's not helpful when you have to take so long to get results, because you may come back negative, and meanwhile you got positive. So it's just impossible. That's why we have to starve the disease down. That's why we have to just get it down to the point where we can do contact tracing, and why we've got to make a big investment in faster turnarounds on testing. And we've got to test strategically. We lost thousands of people in nursing homes in our state. And these deaths, in my judgment, were unnecessary if we had done the right thing. And now we just got to do the right thing.
Well, okay.
And this disease is not Republican or Democrat or independent. This is about all of us pulling together.
Congresswoman, you know, as we see the hospital capacities growing up, again, John, you know, a trauma representative talking about what he's seeing in hospitals. Do you think that we're going to have to reopen those field hospitals that we had set up here in South Florida?
We may. There's no question about it. And they're starting to make plans to do exactly that. But that's why we have this little tiny window that we've got to step up, and our leaders have to step up and say very clearly to people, this is what we have to do. And we've got to do it. We've got to hit it with a hammer. That's the only way I can explain it.
All right.
This COVID-19, we've got to hit it with a hammer and starve it and tell it to leave our county and our state, and so that we can move on.
I want to go back to the phones, and I want to talk to Warren in Wilton Manors. Warren, I appreciate your time. You don't like the idea of a shutdown?
Well, no, I didn't say I didn't like the idea of a shutdown. My business reopened, okay? Now we're shut down again, but I don't hear anything about isolation. So they made me close a business. What's going on? Okay, they didn't do it right. Obviously, it's got to be redone. People are going to hate me for saying it. But if you don't all shut down at once it's not going to work.
Warren, thank you for that. Basically, we're saying, though, we do have to have some essential businesses open, though, Congresswoman.
Yeah, we're talking about gas stations, we're talking about grocery stores, and we're talking about drug stores. But I don't know of anything beyond that. And every business owner knows and understands. I mean, Warren just told you. The worst thing for our businesses and our community is this open and shut, indoors and outdoors. It's not having any sense of certainty. And that's why we have to close down and shut down the right way and reassure people that we're going to do it with all the rigor that we know and follow the advice of public health experts.
Now, we have the City of Miami Mayor Francis Suarez, Miami Beach Mayor Dan Gelber. They're calling for greater federal funding to support coronavirus relief efforts. The House, of course, as you had mentioned, has passed its HEROES Act, but you're still waiting for the Senate.
Yeah, it's waiting for Godot, the Samuel Beckett play.
Okay, I mean, so the situation then becomes this. Are we, as Americans, then just going to have to wait till November and hope there's a switch of position so that we can get something done?
Absolutely not. I'm going up to Washington on Sunday, and I'm not coming back unless I'm coming back with the resources for the beach, for Cutler Bay, for the City of Miami, for South Miami, for Coral Gables, for all the communities in my district, and of course for Miami-Dade. We're going up and we're going to stay until the Senate passes a serious bill that will help our community.
Are you reaching across the aisle? Do you find anybody on the other side? How about Senator Rubio, Senator Nelson, anybody who wants to work with you on this?
Well, unfortunately, Senator Nelson is no longer in the Senate, so we have to deal with
Senator Scott. Sorry. Thank you for that. My apologies.
The answer is that there is bipartisan support in the Senate for getting money to state and local governments for COVID-19. Whether we're debating between $500 million and $1 trillion, that will be part of the negotiations. But the most important thing is we need to get a bill out of the Senate. And Mitch McConnell, the majority leader of the Senate, is going to introduce his bill on Monday. We'll see what he suggests, but that'll be the start of the negotiation. But be assured, I'm not coming home without coming with resources for our community. And not only for our community, for individuals in our community, for people that are running out of unemployment, for more PPP, if we can do it for small businesses. We need to get money into people's pockets, as well as save municipal workers and fill the gaps for the billions that our communities have spent on COVID-19.
I want to thank our guest, U.S. Representative from Miami, Democratic Congresswoman Donna Shalala. Congresswoman, always a pleasure. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
And I want to mention that we have been hearing from you, not just those who have called in. We heard from Kayvon Antonio Hedara on Twitter. He said that he's a reporter covering the pandemic, has diabetes, had COVID. And he says, quote, "We need a change in mentality. American exceptionalism is not immune to the virus. Freedom comes with responsibilities. Our lifestyle is killing us. Cars, diet, habits." Thank you again for sharing your thoughts with us. Always, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Well, still to come, affordable housing in South Florida was already hard to come by, but we're going to look at how the pandemic has complicated things. Maybe some solutions. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, creating affordable housing opportunities in Miami and South Florida was already difficult, way before the pandemic arrived. Earlier this month, we saw the unveiling of a new plan to try and change that. It's called the Miami-Dade Affordable Housing Framework. It's a plan for how leaders in the community can help build, expand, and provide affordable housing opportunities in this coming decade. Joining me now is Annie Lord, Executive Director of the nonprofit Miami Homes for All. Ms. Lord, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
And also joining us is Christine Rupp, the Executive Director of the Dade Heritage Trust. Ms. Rupp, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And by the way, to mention, the trust just announced the creation of an affordable housing unit in Little Havana in an Art Deco building that dates back to the 1930s. We'll talk about that project in a moment. First, Ms. Lord, if I may start with you, we've known about the challenges of affordable housing in South Florida for a long time. We're the most, we are the most rent burdened region in the country. But how has the pandemic exacerbated the problem and the need for affordable housing?
It's a great question, and unfortunately, everything that we understand from the data is that it is exacerbating the problem and making vulnerable households across the county in an even more difficult situation. And in fact, the number of folks that we understand in the county to be especially at risk are 250,000 households. That's about one third of the county's households that are both paying more than they can afford for housing on a month-to-month basis and earning less than $35,000 a year. So, that means they can afford $875 every month for either their rent or their mortgage. And I think that helps people kind of understand how low the wages are in our county and how expensive the housing is. So it's that group of people that represent a third of the county that are especially vulnerable and have been hit especially hard by the economic shutdown caused by the pandemic.
Yeah, Christine Rupp. I mean, we're going to talk about your project here in a moment, but just your thoughts on why it's been so difficult to resolve this problem. Because it's been around for a long time now. This is not new.
Sure. I also want to say it's a pleasure to be here with Annie. Was like a mentor to me when I first started trying to learn about affordable housing and all the issues that are presented here in Miami. So thank you, Annie, personally, for all of your assistance. Dade Heritage Trust takes a refreshing view when it comes to affordability and how we can work on solving the problems, because our focus is really the urban, older urban neighborhoods of Miami that are in need of revitalization without extreme gentrification. So we understand that if we can preserve these older units that also preserve this term naturally occurring affordable housing, we would be on to something to help preserve the aesthetic of the neighborhood, make sure that residents are not displaced, and also, create a better Miami for all in the process.
Is that difficult to do, though, because you're trying to preserve the history, and yet, you're talking about a city that's very expensive, and people with a lot of money might say, hey, I like that idea of the historic aspects of Miami. How do you preserve that history, but also make sure that it doesn't fall into the hands of people with a lot of money?
Well, there's a couple of things that we can do. First of all, with the project that you referred to in Little Havana, we were really fortunate to be able to receive a grant from Miami-Dade County to be able to purchase and rehabilitate the building, and we just closed just 2 weeks ago on July 1st. So without that initial upfront investment, these sort of projects are very difficult because the land costs and the building costs are so expensive here. So part and parcel of that grant requirement from Miami-Dade County is that we must designate this building as historic, and it does indeed meet the criteria. So once the building is declared historic, it is preserved and it cannot be torn down unless there's some really extreme circumstances. So historic designation is key to be able to preserve and take advantage of the incentives that come along with historic designation.
So, Annie, I mentioned that there's this plan, and it came out earlier this month, actually just within the last week, and it falls by the wayside in the news because of the fact that we have a pandemic going on and so many other things, but an important plan because it does lay out a framework for what our leaders could do over the next decade to try to help resolve this problem. It's called the Miami-Dade Affordable Housing Framework. What exactly does it do?
Well, I think First of all, I think it does lay out the plan, as you said, for the next decade and helps us identify the problem and then meet the problem at the scale that it is, which it is large, but it's also a problem with solutions. And so what this plan also tries to do is say, first, let's just do these few things in the next 2 years. Let's build these many units and let's pass these kinds of policies. And so in order for us to be able to, you know, eat the elephant in bites, right? The next 2 years, the priorities fall through, you know, in an acronym called PALM, right? And the first thing is, and I'm really glad to be on this call with Christine too, because she's doing great work, and it represents a viable pathway for one of the major strategies we've got to pursue right away, which is the preservation of affordable housing. And historic designation is a great way to kind of bank that housing. And we've got a long history of doing that on Miami Beach very successfully. So preservation of what we have that's affordable right now is absolutely crucial, because the pandemic has exacerbated the economic pressures on the price of housing, right? And has really increased the gentrification pressure. And then next, we've got to assist renters and owners, partially by creating a mediation program that would allow renters and landlords to negotiate for the payment of their renters' debts. Then we've got to use our land. We have a lot of underused land and vacant land across the county. We've got to use that more efficiently and come up with procedures for actually deploying that land for affordable housing. And then, you know, the M spells money, and that might be a little gauche, but it's also, you know, it's really to the point. We've not invested enough in affordable housing, which houses the employees, the workers that fuel our economy. And I think to Christine's, you know, point, right, we would really like to be able to not only preserve affordability, but we've got to preserve the cultural heritage on which our economy depends. Our tourism economy, even our sort of like local economy around tourism, depends so much, and we commoditize actually the cultural value of our neighborhoods like Little Havana and Little Haiti.
But in the end, you are again providing, you know, politicians and developers an idea on how to create more opportunity for people. And again, not just on the high end of the real estate market. How do you get them to buy into that? Because again, you know, and Christine, I want you to jump in too, is talking about this preserving history, but this is a hot market and there's a lot of money to be made. I mean, do you have the ear of Miami-Dade commissioners? Are they on board with this?
So, you know, if I may, I do think that we have a lot of commissioners that have already contributed quite a bit in order, you know, of their political will and resources in order to support affordable housing measures. It would be great if we could have, you know, more. And I think right now there's a wonderful opportunity. And one of the reasons that any commissioner or the mayor of the county would be supportive is that the jobs that are projected to grow the most, the occupations, according to the State Department of Economic Opportunity, 8 out of the 10 highest growth jobs pay less than $16 an hour. So earners, workers in our community, as well as, you know, our elders that are on fixed incomes, right, they're earning a pretty low wage. And so in order for our economy to drive, for us to be able to enjoy the benefits of, you know, what this community has to offer, we have to have a place for people to live that they can afford.
Well, it's true. We do have to have that. And Christine, I want to hear your thoughts on this. I mean, we do. But again, and the other thing about this community is a lot of the revenue comes from housing. And so, of course, the more valuable that housing, the more the revenue.
Sure. We have to find ways to incentivize developers and other organizations, even nonprofits like Dade Heritage Trust, to invest in these older properties, because statistically, it's much cheaper to purchase and rehabilitate these multifamily units than to build brand new units. So when you're preserving the identity of a neighborhood, as Annie stated, and preserving these lovely buildings, yet providing much better living conditions, because even though these buildings are currently available, the living conditions are not wonderful. And so we have to let these residents of this existing affordable housing understand that we care about them, that we care about how they're living. and we want to give them a sense of empowerment that will create more community engagement. So we have to incentivize developers to look at this holistically. And there are incentives out there, from historic tax credits when you designate a building to being able to sell and transfer development rights and sell development density. And the city of Miami is working very hard to promote those incentives, to bring more people on board to be able to preserve these houses. The other thing is that in urban Miami, with these lower income neighborhoods, they're walkable, they're close to transit, all of those things that working class people need to ensure, you know, they're not paying for parking, they don't. That's why we have the density in Little Havana, which is so wonderful.
Yeah.
That creates that vibe.
Let me, to jump in for time, Annie, I wanted to ask you that, again, this is a project that looks at the next decade, but one of the things that had to change is the fact that we have a pandemic we're dealing with now. How did that change the framework?
Yeah, we had to rewrite it. and I think, you know, we always cared about, you know, how folks were going to make it day to day, right? And so it was important that we saw some measures in the plan always that would improve the ability for both tenants and homeowners to you know, have rights and have the have the ability to stay where they are. But it just became much more important that we look at some really impactful measures. And I think, you know, one really important thing that we can do is look at a way to mandate a mediation program that would prevent evictions and foreclosures. This is something that's been very successful in the aftermath of the 2008 recession. If we can create payment plans that are feasible for both tenants and landlords, tenants to their landlords to their lenders, then, you know, everybody can save money on legal fees and people can stay where they are.
And Annie, briefly, how fast do you think all of this could be put into place? How fast do you think things will start happening?
Well, you know, what's cool is, not that affordable housing is super cool, but what I'm excited about is that, you know, there's already been quite a bit of work laid out. So, for example, that mediation program, that's something that, you know, wouldn't require an act of state legislation. That could be something that's implemented at the local level through administrative orders. In terms of an actual development of deals, the Miami-Dade County administration has actually identified about 15,000 units that are in the pipeline and, you know, set to come online in the next 2 to 3 years. And that's a starting place. We've still got a lot of work to do, but there's been good work done.
Again, the plan is called the Miami-Dade Affordable Housing Framework. You want to learn more about it, you can find it on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Also, this new project in Little Havana, you can find out more about that as well. I want to thank our guest, Annie Lord, Executive Director of the nonprofit Miami Homes for All, and Christine Rupp, the Executive Director of the group Dade Heritage Trust. Annie, Christine, thank you so much. I really appreciate the time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, still to come, what's it like to give birth during a pandemic? This story and more featured in a film festival this week. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, you know, with all the COVID-19 related shutdowns, we can't go to film festivals like we used to. That doesn't mean they don't exist, though. They're still happening. Oolite Arts is hosting an online microfilm festival. It's happening tomorrow. And the films are different from what we're used to because, well, the filmmakers had to work with the restrictions of the pandemic. Now, these are short films, mostly shot at home. There are 12 local filmmakers highlighted in the festival, and I want to welcome two of them now, Pamela Longsword and Juan Castaneda, joining us now. Pamela, Juan, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having us.
Hi, thank you. Thank you very much.
Juan, your film is called Echo Chamber. It's about misinformation and conspiracy theories, especially around COVID-19. What was the inspiration for this?
Well, the inspiration is not hard to miss. I mean, when you're quarantined, then you start seeing what everybody around you starts thinking. You start going a little bit doubting everything. You start crazy, you know, going a little bit crazy when you see your uncles, your friends coming up with these crazy theories. And that was a source of inspiration, you know, the other crazy things that happened in a pandemic.
Yeah, and your film is, I mean, it's, again, all of these films are very short films, a few minutes. Your film is one actor, one performer. Tell me a little bit about how you shot this and where you shot it.
I shot it a block away from my house on this little bridge that connects some buildings. And it was one actress. We did a lot of After Effects stuff. So there's like, had 1.10 actresses, but it's her. And it's everybody just talking to her. Everybody kind of having that conversation with her or herself, basically. You know, her looking for the truth.
And as you said, it's interesting. It's one actor, but yet at one point it feels like there's 10 different people in the film. And it opens it really, I mean, Juan, what I took it as, it's almost, it's like all the different voices in our head.
Exactly. That's basically it. And the interesting fact there is that the actress that I cast, she's deaf. So Echo Chamber is, you have a deaf actor going crazy with all the voices in her head.
And I want to ask you about that as well. But Pamela, let me jump over to you. Your film is called Kairi during COVID. Did I say that right?
Yeah, Kairi.
Oh, Kairi during COVID. It's a documentary. This is really interesting because this is about you, your experience giving birth. And so you're behind the camera. You're in front of the camera. Had you ever done anything like this?
Oh my God.
Mean, besides giving birth, have you ever done anything else like that was this intimate?
No, honestly, I typically do like short narrative films, with scripts and, you know, design and actors and all that, but this is my first attempt at a documentary style. And, it's like, wow, first of many things, giving birth, being in a hospital setting, shooting on my iPhone. I got inspiration from Sean Baker to shoot, and, I was already documenting.
I mean, Pamela, yeah. this is such an intimate thing, right? Is giving birth. Why did you want to share your story?
Well, during the whole journey, I noticed a bunch of things changing rapidly, day by day. Certain hospitals wouldn't let guests go with the mother to go in labor and to actually deliver. And I made sure to look for a hospital that would actually allow me at least one guest with me the entire time.
Yeah.
And also with birthing centers, I made a bunch of phone calls. I was really nervous about it. And even going to my appointments, the father couldn't come with me. I had to go in by myself to the ultrasounds, and I was like, this isn't really the experience that any mom would want during a pandemic. And I thought it was something important to kind of put a microscope under.
And that is something that is the, I think the weird part about it is like giving birth during a pandemic that there are going to be times when the woman can't even have their partner with them. That is odd to me. There is a scene in the film I wanted to share. This is from the beginning of the film. Let's take a listen.
Hi, how can I help you?
Hi, I'm coming in to give birth. My water broke. My name is Pamela Largespada.
Okay, just three quick questions. Have you guys traveled outside of the state of Florida in the last 2 weeks?
No.
Any respiratory symptoms?
No.
Any fever?
No.
And have you guys been in contact with anybody that has tested positive?
No.
All right, so I'm thinking, Pamela, it's already challenging enough to try to make a film, but you're giving birth. How did you balance the two things?
So, I made an agreement. I made a promise with my partner, and I told him, you know, you're going to see something aside of me as a director that you've never seen before, because he's not a filmmaker in any kind. And, I need you to just listen to me. And, it was a support unlike any other, cause I'm in pain, and he'll pick up the camera and the phone, and I would think, oh my God, can we do that again? Can you just like rehearse that? And okay, we're going to do it again. Play, record, and then I would do the settings for the framing. I would do the settings for the 4K, and then I would hand it off to him. And mind you, I'm like in contractions, and I'm like, and things really took a turn when there were, well, I don't want to spoil it, but things really took a turn, and he decided to take the wheel on major parts. And there's some footage that I didn't even know existed because he just kept recording.
Yeah.
And, it was amazing.
Again, you're in the middle of childbirth, and you have to be a director to somebody who doesn't know how to film. They're amateurs. That in of itself is amazing. We're talking with two filmmakers, Pamela Longsword and Juan Castaneda. They are two of the 12 filmmakers featured in the Oolite Arts Online Micro Film Festival. The event is free. You can find more information on how to RSVP on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Juan, you know, you mentioned, well, first let me ask you this. I mean, because we're talking about challenges that filmmakers already face, what was like the biggest challenge for you? You know, in living in a pandemic, you have to be safe. But how did you do it?
Actually, the biggest problem was it was a series of problems. I had to shoot at night, and first, you know, we had the pandemic, so you know, organizing that was a problem. But then there was a curfew because there was a lot of things going on right now, a lot of protests. So you know, we had to cancel for that. And when we finally had a chance to shoot, it started raining. And it was outside. So, you know, Florida summer kind of came in. But finally, we had a window and we shot the whole thing like in 2.5 hours. So, you know, that was the best part.
As you said, your actress in the film, I mean, is deaf and communicates with sign language throughout the film. That adds an extra challenge to a filmmaker.
It does. It definitely does. And actually communicating with her was simpler than I thought. It went great. I think the biggest challenge I had with her was that when you're shooting, you like to do close-ups and you like to do all these type of angles. But when someone's speaking with their hands, which is the whole point I like working with deaf actors, is you have to leave a big enough frame so you can see their hands moving. And many times I'd have to kind of pull back the camera just to get to see the whole language. So it adds a new level of, you know, capturing a performance.
You know, from all of this experience, I'm wondering, you know, what do you gain from it that will help you as a filmmaker moving forward in your life? We're going to get through this eventually, but how do you change as a filmmaker? Juan, I'll start with you.
With this experience as a whole?
Yeah.
I mean, it makes us understand how small we are, how delicate our whole society is, and in a way, how important arts are. You know, we are the ones that are hopefully channeling some of the stories that are coming out and the importance of all of this. So I think it's changed. It's made me more aware of my role.
And Pamela, for you, because as you mentioned, this is, I mean, again, first of all, by the way, I never mentioned it. Congratulations. You're a mom. Cause you just had a baby in May. I mean, that's fantastic. I hope you're doing well.
Thank you. I am.
But you know, for you, because this was a new experience for you, you know, a new type of film for you. What do you think all of this is teaching you as a filmmaker? How's it going to change the way you make movies?
Well, I think it always stems from the cornerstone of indie filmmaking is working with what you have got and not letting that be an obstacle for you. As organically as possible, work with your friends, work with what you have at hand. You have an idea, like shoot really big. And then just keep going for it because I had no idea I was going to document something as important as this. And I think the biggest lesson I learned was just to keep going and don't be afraid to shoot everything until they tell you to stop shooting. Just keep shooting. I think that's really important.
Yeah, no. And I, you know, if they maybe even being doctors tell you to stop or we're trying to get your baby out. Pamela, what's next for you? What do you think is the next project?
Well, I'm currently on the next project. I kind of hit the ground running. I'm currently producing a short film called Water. It was one of the Sundance Workshop projects recently that I also was into. I was like fully 9 months pregnant in a Sundance online workshop for the short film intensives here. And it was also funded by the Knout Foundation and also support from Oolite Arts. And so we're taking one of those projects and being very careful with the whole COVID situation right now. But it's a really important short film directed by Brittany Ray. And funny enough, one of the producers on Water is actually one of the filmmakers featured in the Oolite Film Festival.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, his name is Francie. I love how this South Florida filmmaking circle is really like coming up and, you know, you get to work in different social circles, but Yeah, I'm currently working on that. We're filming at the end of the month, and we need everybody's support on this.
Well, congratulations. And Juan, what about you? What's up for you?
Well, actually, I just finished shooting another short film, which is also a proof of concept for a series I'm working on called American Diablo, about a deaf Latin superhero. I've been working on that for a while, so yeah.
Fantastic. Well, listen, both of you, congratulations on this, and best of luck for both of you moving forward. I really appreciate it.
Great. Thank you so much for giving us the time.
Thank you so much.
And yeah, again, just to thank my filmmakers, Pamela Longsword and Juan Castaneda, for joining us. Again, you can find their films making their debut tomorrow at the Oolites Arts Online Microfilm Festival. The event is free. Find more information on how to RSVP on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Well, that's our program for this Tuesday, July 14th. We don't have a show tomorrow because of the Miami-Dade School Board meeting, but we will be recording a conversation with the president of the University of Miami, Dr. Julio Frank. The university is still developing their plan for classes this fall. What question do you have for President Frank? We'll ask those questions tomorrow. Plus, you're going to hear our conversation with Dr. Eileen Marty, the infectious disease expert from FIU. She'll discuss some of the political pressures that she's faced from the county as a member of the coronavirus task force.
Politics is also part of living. I mean, every business and everything that you do has an influence that way. I try to the best of my ability to provide the clearest information that I can regardless.
Again, that conversation, both of those coming up on Thursday. And if you want to ask that question to Dr. Frank, just email us sundial@WLRNnews. And let us know. Again, I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for tuning in. We always appreciate it. As always, please stay safe. We'll talk to you again on Thursday.